Well, we left off in the middle of some excitement. It was sort of a cat fight between Brunhilde and Gutruni. Everybody swore, except Hagen on his sword, that the truth would be out and moral justice would be served. But what happens at that point in the story is that all of the Gibichung vassals, they get scandalized, which is exactly what you'd expect of the ordinary folk. They're shocked by everything because their consciousness is not open to very much. And people are excited or excitable. We've just seen that in recent West Coast history. But at any rate, Siegfried tells Gunther, control your wife. And he's almost speaking of Brunhilde now as though she's some kind of hillbilly hick or something like that needs to be controlled and have better manners. And Siegfried, at the same time, he's perplexed. He can't figure out how Brunhilde wasn't completely fooled by the Tarnhelm, because everybody else gets fooled when he puts it on and takes on a disguise. He doesn't realize the real power of intuition, because the power of intuition can see through and get to the heart of the matter and get to the essential life that is within, instead of all the forms that that life may take externally, or that it might throw off from itself. So, not knowing what to do and sensing an embarrassing state of things, he appeals to the vassals and he says, let's drink lustfully or lustily and be mirthful. And just what we need, just something like that to laugh away our sins and be cheery and happy. This leaves behind Brunhilde and Hagen. And what happens is that Brunhilde asks for, rhetorically, she's chagrined, and she asks for someone to cut away her bonds. Her dedication is lost in now that she thinks that Siegfried, to whom she was united for eternity, has pulled away from her. And I think we've all gone through that kind of moment, that even in our highest state, we've been dejected, and in that dejection, we didn't maintain the spirit and left ourselves lay open to things. And Hagen immediately volunteers. How noble of him. He immediately volunteers. He says, I will avenge for all of your sins. And Brunhilde laughs at him, and she says, you couldn't possibly stand up to Siegfried, because if he just looked your way wrong, you would be knocked over. And Hagen insists. He knows how to keep up the appearances. And he tells Brunhilde that he must keep all of the oaths sacred, and he must punish perjury. Everybody, when you become a defender of the faith, or when you become even a defender of the law, it's usually a sign that there's something hypocritical that's going on. And he asks her secret counsel in how she might help him to keep the oath sacred. And she tells him that she has put on to Siegfried a spell, and that this spell has him impregnable by her magic to any force that would attack him. Truly, the protection that the hero or heroine has is the quality of positively loving. I think it is, you know, all of these things about psychic self-defense and all of those kinds of books I consider spiritual nonsense. There may be precautions to take, and one should not be foolhardy, but the only real defense is to be positive and to be loving. If one does that, one has such a untarnished aura that there is no need for defense of any kind. But Hagen is got some of the dark one in him, and he looks for a loophole, and he says, if is Siegfried completely and totally invulnerable? And she says, in battle, yes. But she said she didn't protect the middle of his backside because she knew he would never turn his back and run. And so she knew then that he was vulnerable. Now this brings up something that I've mentioned in some of the other myth talks last year. It brings up something that I don't understand and don't know about, and if in your studies you run into it, it's something that's a fascination for me. If you remember, the Greek hero Achilles was similarly protected, only he was protected by an old woman, or was it by a goddess that put him in the fire and protected him in the fire? Oh, yes, that's right. Yes. And in his heel, he was the only spot that he could be harmed, which brings something that is the Siegfried spot is right in the middle of the back between the shoulder blades. It's a very vulnerable spot, which means then that there are spots in the heel ruled by Aquarius and in Leo that the warrior hero is vulnerable to harm. And I don't understand that at all. I think it's trying to say something, but I don't exactly know what it is. I understand the vulnerability of the Achilles tendon and all of that. And I understand that the various vertebrae are very sensitive, but I don't understand why that particular thing. And it also has something to do, I think, with the children of Jacob, in that the original defilement was by Reuben, who defiled his father's bed, and Reuben is representative of Aquarius, and I don't understand it. And so if you have any ideas along the way, it would be very helpful to me. All right. But Hagen now has what he wants, and old Gunther is still there. And he asks Gunther, why are you sad when you now have this good wife, the most beautiful woman or the most true woman in the world? And Gunther says he's filled with shame, and he wants Hagen's help to regain his honor. Clearly, then, if Siegfried represents the hero, the personal or the human that has attained to union with self in a spiritual initiation, clearly, then, Gunther represents the human of the world. And that's really clear because he represents shame. Shame is an emotion that is a consequence of our relating the circumstances of our existence with the world. Public, you know, there has to be a public to be ashamed before, and shows that where all of his values are, he could never be a hero because for the hero, the truth is within self. And the world, you know, the world be damned almost. No hero would ever really quite say that. Hagen, realizing that he has a vulnerability here, says, only Siegfried's death can expiate the shame. Now, this is really interesting because it raises the question, if Hagen's shame is external, then the source of his shame must also be external. And Hagen is almost in the same position that a lot of people are with regard to their health. I mean, Gunther is in a position that a lot of people are with regard to their health. They think that something outside of themselves produces their ills, their ailments, and therefore someone outside of themselves has to be responsible for fixing it. And there literally are people that go to the doctors and they say, "Fix me. You know, I'm broken. I need help," as though they were a machine. So Gunther really doesn't understand that his honor is something that has to reside within himself, and it has nothing to do with the life or death of anyone. And when you think about it, how can the removal of someone else have anything to do with honor? It just doesn't make any sense at all. But that's the way the world tends to think. The world refuses to bear responsibility for its actions. And that's pretty much the state that the world is in right now, because all of our belief is materialistic, the general belief right now being science, and science believes only in external things, and that we evaluate the truth of something according to how it relates to external verification and not with regard to its inward spiritual nature. And this is an enforced extroversion. And until we can come back to our spiritual unity, somehow we have to be shocked away from this attachment or weaned from this attachment to matter or external things being the source of truth. But at any rate, Hagen diverts Gunther and he starts talking to him about the. They begin talking about, I'm sorry, they begin talking about Siegfried. And he asks, "Did Siegfried betray me?" And Brunhilde takes her cue from that, and she says, "Yes, he betrayed everyone." And she goes on, carrying on in her own woe, saying that me most of all. I have been harmed, and I am the spirit of truth. Of course, she can't say that because these people would never understand it. But I most of all have been harmed, and she comes to the conclusion that Siegfried must die for his unfaithfulness. She says it outright. Now, this is interesting because normally the spirit protects us. But to the spirit, life or death doesn't mean anything. The truth means something. How we live means something, but the fact that we live or die doesn't mean anything. The all is in the quality of our existence and not in the length of our existence or anything like that. So the spirit knows that at some time, in order for the truth to be redeemed and in order for Siegfried to really regain his own honor, he has to be consumed. At this point, Hagen is afraid that Gunther is going to get too much of an earful about what's going on, and so he begins talking about the ring, and he uses that as a ploy to distract Gunther. And then he tells he has a plan. He says, "We'll go on a boar hunt tomorrow, and somehow something will happen that will lead to Siegfried's demise." And at this point, Brunhilde, very much wounded, is still talking, and she's talking to some extent about her jealousy for Gutruna, the fact that the attention has been alienated to the woman that represents the world, and the whole act ends with the three of them each singing, or the two of them, Hagen and Brunhilde, singing, but you don't even know who's singing what words. They sing about honor and sacred oaths and power and the ring, and even the instructions are not who is supposed to sing what. You can somewhat tell from the music, but it's no longer a dialogue. It's everything just flows into one, and there's just it's not even a duet. It's just two people singing at about the same time. Okay, and then we come to the last act, and his last acts are usually his very strongest, as we saw last time when we talked about Siegfried going to the mountaintop and claiming Brunhilde for his own. Now, the last act begins where the whole four dramas began. It begins at the Rhine River with the stony precipice that is over it. And the Rhine maidens return after about 8 or 10 hours of being out of the action. They return and they sing a lovely, lovely song. They're sporting in the water, and this is what they sing. The lady sun spreads beams of light in the depths. It is night. Once it was bright there, when safe and fair, our father's gold glistened there still. Rhined gold, pure gold, how brightly once thou didst shine, resplendent star of the deep, wee la la, wee la la, wee la la. Lady sun, send us the hero who shall give us back the gold. If he let us have it, we should envy no more thy bright eye. Rhine gold, pure gold, how joyously then would thou shine, free star of the deep. It's talking, of course, about the inner light that shines before which the sun would be worth nothing if the universal spirit were turned over back to the innocents rather than being used for individual and personal ends. As they are singing and they trail off with their singing and the sun is beginning to rise higher, Siegfried's horn is heard. And a little bit later he appears up on the rocky precipice up on the top, and he's following what he calls a little elf, which is really another one of these bears that he likes to fight with. And it has eluded him, and it has gotten away, and it has led him to the banks of the Rhine River. He comes down from the rock, and the wish, I don't know how to say this, the wish of the Rhine maidens is sort of like the wish of the spiritual intelligence that is behind nature. And when they say they would like to have the hero and they would like to have their gold come back to them, they get what they want, because it isn't for them alone that they're, because they are pure and because they are unselfish and are not only keepers of the gold, but are worthy of that spiritual quality. Everything they accomplish by a harmonious kind of expression. As Siegfried comes down to the water, they come up back up to the surface again, and they start playing with him and joking, as is their way to do. Remember the way they did with Albrecht quite a long while ago. And he asks them if they have his quarry. And they sportingly ask him, what would he give them if they gave him his game? And he asks, what would they like? And they, of course, say, the ring. And Siegfried is a pretty generous guy. He says, but I slew a dragon for it. I should trade it in for a mere bear skin. You know, here I risked my life against this fierce thing. And they taunt and tease him laughingly. And he says, tease away. I'll never give you something for your teasing. He's already got the pride of ordinary humans. He's fallen back quite a bit. And I don't know how to say it. This is the way, the evocative way that nature speaks to us. If we are trying to discover the inner meaning of nature, and if we are trying to draw out the unknown that is manifest in nature as part of the creative way, it speaks in that evocative, teasing sort of way for us. Nature just doesn't out and out tell us what its secrets are. And that's because it's an expression of whole consciousness. And whole consciousness can't really be delineated and say this is this and that is that, and it can't be that specific, that if we want that kind of information with our delineatory consciousness, we have to enter into that whole and make some kind of a loop through it. They depart. They swim back under the water. And what does Siegfried do? He takes the ring off. He's remorseful because he recognizes really that these were not harmful creatures at all, that they were really beautiful creatures. And he calls them back. Calls them back to the surface, and he's already beginning to have a change of heart. He can't be a drinking man, and he can't be a worldly man. And when he confronts something so pure as the Rhine Maidens and what they represent, something he knows something is missing. And he really is a hero, and he is willing to sacrifice the ring. But what happens is when the Rhine Maidens come back, they're of a totally different nature. They're much more sullen, and they tell him, keep your ring until you understand the full meaning of its ill luck. And this is, I think, the way it is with the spiritual worlds. If the gods present themselves to you, I don't know how to say it. Things seem to go by opposites with regard to the spiritual worlds. Like in the desire world, if you are aggressive, things come charging at you. If you withdraw, things pull away from you. When Siegfried was selfish, the nature spirits pulled away from him. But the tables are altogether turned now. When the Rhine Maidens presented themselves in their pure, innocent ways, this was an offering. They offered him the opportunity. It's something that happens to us all the time. Never does it happen that ill befalls us without us getting some kind of warning, and without us getting some kind of trial so that we could learn the lesson without ill befalling us. And had he just the first time handed over the ring to them with the same kind of purity that they had, it would have been fine. But now when he has to command the gods, which he has the right to do as a hero, when he has to command them to present themselves, they're going to come on with a totally different kind of mien. And that's exactly what happens. They appear sullen. It's no longer that they're presenting themselves in generosity and in a graceful way. It is, They now present themselves as he is, because he's coming to this very same thing himself. And what they basically tell him is, don't give up your experiences. You've made your choice. Now don't give up your experience until you've lived it through all the way. Meaning, like we can't say that once it starts to hurt, oh, help me, heal me right away. We've chosen our experience and we should live it through. He reacts with pique. He's proud. And he says, I won't... They start telling him. They start singing him the song of the ring and its curse and of his death if he doesn't give it up. Because now that he has fully consciously called them and demand them to come, they want a fully conscious sacrifice, not just an innocent one. They want a fully conscious sacrifice. And he reacts with pique and he says, I'm not going to fall for your flattery. And you know that that's that what's going to come after that. Once he gets really proud before the innocents and says he's not going to fall for their things, then he starts not only getting proud, but he starts, they warn him, his fate is coming ripe. And he boasts of all of his feats and all of his fearlessness. And it's like the old statement goes, who the gods destroy, they first make mad with power. And the Rhine maidens say, let's leave the fool, there's nothing we can do. Let's see if I can find where they say it, because there are some interesting things in that. Come, says sisters, let us leave the fool. So wise and strong the hero weans himself. So wise and strong the hero weans himself. Bound and blind though he is, oaths he swore and keeps them not. Runes he knows and heeds them not. A wonderful gift was granted, a gift was granted to him. That he has spurned it, he knows it not. Only the ring that will bring them death, the ring alone he holds fast. Farewell, Siegfried, a proud woman will inherit from you. A proud woman today will inherit from you. She will give us better hearing to her. Wee la la, wee la la, wee la la, and they dive off into the river. This is the secret of the ring. Everybody who has held it has held it. They're bound by it. And everybody who has held it has gone into ignorance. Like Wotan, when he held it, he began to act stupidly. Probably the clearest action is when Fafnir held the ring and he went to sleep. He became a sleeping dragon. That there's something about, even though the ring represents the objective consciousness, there are two sides to it. You know very clearly and very objectively everything that is inside the ring. Everything that is inside the ring. But that kind of knowledge in and of itself blinds you from everything that is outside the ring. Now that he's held the ring, he would have been an ultra hero probably had he given up the ring and taken that kind of objective consciousness that comes from being within the ring and expanded that to the realm that was being offered to him by the Rhine maidens. He didn't do that. So ignorance is the consequence, and out of that ignorance, a knowledge is born, but it's a knowledge that is born of consequences. And in a way now, everything has come full circle. Everything is now coming, to its end. The loop of destiny that is the cycle, it is a cycle of life of Siegfried, as both on the rising side when he rose up to spirituality and awareness, and on the fall side where he has fallen away from it. So his whole cycle is there. And as they swim away, he is in sort of a bitter kind of self-importance, and he's ignorant, really, of all of his own treacheries, as we all are. And sometimes we have to be slapped in the face by them. And he prides himself in knowing the ways of women. And so not only has he become a proudful man, he's become an insolent man. At one time he was afraid or awed by women, that is when he was with Brunhilde on the rock, and now he has profaned that whole consciousness, and he's a complete subject of the illusion of being inside the ring, because that knowing is not knowing with a capital K. And so he thinks he knows what he really doesn't know, and is in for trouble. As soon as the Rhine maidens have disappeared, other hunting horns are heard, and up on the top of the rock, Hagen and Gunther and the other hunters appear, and Siegfried beckons them to come down to the cool water. It's hot up on the top of the rock, and Hagen suggests that they take a break from hunting, and Siegfried, who is a healthy young boy who's always hungry, says, "That's a great idea, let's stop and eat." And what happens is that Hagen primes him with wine, gives him plenty of wine, and Siegfried gets loose-tongued. This is the whole situation again. Why a drink is what caused him to forget and caused him to become worldly, to turn off the inward spiritual consciousness, and that drink was clearly the drink of wine. We know that from Christian mysticism, that the effect of wine turns off clairvoyance. Now he's about to drink the second draft, the draft of remembrance, and they start talking. And they start talking about bird talk, of all things. And let's see, there's a little section that I would read. Oh yeah, it tells just exactly how bad Hagen is trying to bring him a remembrance out of Siegfried, and asks him how, if he can still hear the language of the birds. This is what Siegfried says. It really is profaned at this point. "Since I heard women singing, I have quite forgotten the birds." Statement very much of where things are. Hagen could see through and he knew what was going on. But anyway, Siegfried gets a little loose-tongued and he starts spinning the story of Mima and of the sword and how he was able to forge the sword and of Fafnir. And he tells the story of the dragon's blood and of the bird and of the treasure and of the ring and of the Tarnhelm. So he starts telling the whole story all over again. So this is already he has passed the nadir in his descent, because he's singing his swan song. He's telling his whole story. In one way, he told it to Brunhilde in the early part of the initiation, but now in his final leaving as a human, he's singing his swan song, and he tells the whole thing. Swans, when they die, are supposed to sing a song that they only sing once in their life, according to bird lore. They only sing it at the moment of their death. And it's very interesting. It's one of those things that in moments of death that we all go into retrospection mode. And I have sidelong things got into my mind there. But at moments of death, we all tend to do that because we tend to go back and relive our life because we understand that. It's very curious. In mating, does the same thing. It's a well-known fact to most women that men, especially, if they are seducing a woman, a part of their ritual is they tell their life story, and it is their swan song. What I was thinking of was this famous television personality in Madison here once picked up this woman and took her out in the middle of Lake Mendota and started singing his swan song to her, trying to get into her heart. And she said she didn't like it one bit, and take her home. And he said, either you listen or swim. And she jumped out of the boat and swam. But those notions about sex and death, each being a different kind of death, hold true in that there is that tendency to pour our heart out in those moments, which is, that's probably the real death at that point. And the vassals ask if he ever heard the birds sing again. And then Siegfried says, yes, the bird told me about Mima and how he knew how to avoid Mima's poison and eventually do in Mima. At this point, Hagen offers him another drink, and this one's got the anti-Mickey Finn. This is the draft of remembrance. Only with the draft of remembrance, he comes back to his full memory with the same kind of innocent consciousness that he had in the spirit. And he's no longer the sassy young man. And then he boldly, in the joy of remembering what it was, he boldly sings out of how the bird also told him of the beautiful woman that was on the top of the mountain. And it's one of those things, when you're filled with the truth, it has to come out. It's like the Freudian slips that we've mentioned, that in some ways the Freudian slips are always embarrassing to us, and Freud got it just wrong. Freud got it, he said, in such a way that what he called them, symptomatic actions, that what comes out when a person is... he thinks it's the desire of the lower nature, the unconscious lower nature, which he considered to be a very primitive thing, which we in our civilized way tend to hold in abeyance. And then when we're not careful, if we're tired or if we have divided motivations, then the things slip out and the truth be known. About our base ways. But what he doesn't realize is that pushing behind those base ways is indeed the spirit of truth. It wants us exposed to ourselves, and it wants us to be embarrassed. It wants us to be like in the Garden of Eden in a spiritually way, to be naked and to see what we are. And so it forces those things out, and this is where it is with Siegfried. He's filled with it now, and so he tells the whole truth. And then Hagen is all ready for this, and he leaps up in apparent horror, and as he does so, the ravens fly again. They're in the bushes behind them, and the two ravens fly toward the Rhine River. Now this ties it all together and says it's gonna, you know, like everything is returning not only for Siegfried, but the ravens are going back to Wotan. So this puts it again on a cosmic scale throughout all nature. This impends, the dark ravens are now flying, and that means that there's a heavy death that's going to be coming. And he points to the ravens as they fly away, and he says, can you read their voice? And he doesn't even know what he's done. He just did it to distract Siegfried. So even the evildoer, Hagen, is speaking a great truth. And when Siegfried turns to look at the ravens, Hagen stabs him in the back. And then a most interesting thing happens. All of the hunting crew, which are the same vassals that were at the wedding, say, "Hagen, what are you doing?" And then they say, "Hagen, what have you done?" And they do it in such a way that the tenses are clear. This is a big moment. And in the big moment, the consciousness is always clear. If you've ever talked to somebody that's gone through a serious accident, where they see another car coming right at them, everything seems to go slow motion. The reason everything seems to go slow motion is that this is a big moment for them. That even in this, the pain of this accident, they're going to learn something. And they recognize that something is at stake and all of their attention is there. And when all of their attention is there, their consciousness is in the eternal, and it's sped up to eternal type of time, and it seems like everything else has slowed down, and the passing of this moment, so when the vassals sing, "Hagen, what are you doing?" and then say, "Hagen, what have you done?" it's like that moment is slowed down, and it is carried in that eternal kind of time. Hagen very forcefully said, "I have avenged perjury." Siegfried is given one last little solo in there. See if I can find it. Oh, yes. Oh, I don't know if I can read it. "Brunhilde, holy bride, wake up. Open your eyes. Who has enwrapped you in sleep again? Who has bound you in slumber's bonds? The awakener has come to kiss you again, and again he has broken the bride's bonds. Brunhilde's joy smiles in her eyes. Ah, those eyes now open forever. The rapturous sighs of her breathing, ah, sweet passing, dreaded yet desired, Brunhilde gives me greeting." Now, some people would say he's hallucinating. But what he now recognizes that Brunhilde is the spirit of truth, and not just in the property of that body that she has been inhabiting for dramatic purpose, but that he realizes his error and he is leaving behind the material things, and he knows now he is no longer an innocent hero, he is a guilty hero. He no longer has innocence, he now has virtue. He couldn't go back now and make the same mistakes again because he realizes the consequence of them. And so when he begins to open his eyes to the spiritual worlds again, as his physical body is dying, he knows this is forever, and he sees the spirit of truth in a more universal sense and not in a personal sense. Then they take his shield and they place him in his shield and they carry him back to the Gebichungs, to the temple of the castle of the Gebichungs. And if this is really beautiful in a number of ways, the shield, as we said, represented the soul body, the thick, solid, etheric soul body that comes from service and that comes from a pure, holy way. He now is living truly in his soul body and he's being born back. And Wagner does one of the most beautiful things, I think, in the history of music. There is, as the scene is changed back to the hall of the Gebichums, there is what is called Siegfried's funeral march. And this is the march of in honor of the hero. And what Wagner does, right in the middle of this march, he stops and he puts the opening strains in from, I believe, the second movement of the Ninth Symphony by Beethoven. And he just does it as long as he's honoring one hero, he honors another hero, and it's completely out of context of everything else in the entire opera, but he thought that Beethoven and the beauty of the music of Beethoven needed an honoring. And as egoistic of a man as Wagner was, he does such a generous homage to Beethoven that it's really a lovely thing. It's quite something. And so the final scene opens up at the Hall of the Gebichungs. And Gertruna is in the hall, or comes out of the hall, complaining of bad dreams about the horse grain and Brunhilde's laughter. And she is intuitive enough to sense that something is going on, and she understands the mixture of dreams and reality, and she understands the laughter of truth, the freedom between them. And so she's sort of going back and forth between a very worldly kind of instinct and at the same time a true spiritual intuition. At this moment, Hagen is becoming more bold and cleverly so all the time, and he comes in and announces, "Siegfried the great hero has returned home." And Gutruni is distressed, and she says, "I didn't hear his horn." And then Hagen, he very cunningly leads things, and he says, "He won't blow his horn anymore, or hunt or court women anymore." And Gutruna asks what they are bringing. And Hagen says, they're starting to bring the corpse. They're carrying it. And Hagen says, "A wild boar's fallen prey. Your husband's dead." And Gutrun falls on the corpse. She's just utterly distressed. And Gunther begins to console her. And Gutruna rails at him for taking out her husband. And he, in all of his courage, says, "Hagen did it." You know how it is. Everybody wants an end. And we selfishly weaken ourselves in wanting and trying to get these given ends. But then we always point the finger and blame somebody else. We even try to set it up so somebody else suggests it. Hagen knew this all the while, and he set them all up. And Hagen, on the other hand, very boldly says, "Yes, I did it. He was assigned to my spear." And it's true, because he swore on his, Siegfried swore on that spear that if he was lying or untrue, that he said, "Take my life by it." You see, what's happening is, with great insight, Wagner understands the nature of evil. Somebody was just telling me about crack babies last night, that when they grow up, they have brain damage, and the brain damage is in the moral parts of the brain, and that they grow up and they're utterly ruthless to other kids. They'll pick up a chair and smash him, and they'll laugh at the blood running down their head, because they seem to be utterly without conscience, because they can't express it through their body, because that part of the brain has been destroyed. And that sort of describes the general evolution and development of humanity. most of the humanity will become more gentle and more loving and more honoring of the truth. But some are going to go the other way. And when they go the other way, they're going to be more brazenly so. You can pull off a con if you're really brazen about it. You can pull off these kinds of things. And as things go on, Hagen becomes more and more bold. And it was with great insight into the nature of evil that Wagner does that. Hagen, as he gets more bold, he says, I claim the ring by right of conquest. He really puts it out there. Unlike the Rhine maidens, but very much like Albrecht, he believes in force. He believes that the individual, for its own good, has the right to overpower other beings. This is the fall of selfishness when we take power into our own hands, and instead of allowing the whole to do for us what must be done, we have responsibilities, but when we selfishly take care of ourselves, that's the ultimate of it. Gunther says, you can't have it. It's mine. I'm the king. And Hagen appeals to the crowd, saying, I overcame them. It should be mine. And Hagen knows. You see, Hagen is the one that got the crowd all stirred up by the whole scandal of the whole business in the first place. Just the opposite of Socrates. There could be 20, 30, 40 people around watching an argument of Socrates and somebody else, and he didn't care what anybody else thought. All he cared about was the one person that he was talking with. Is this true or is this not true? Not who's talking or who's thinking it is, or even where the thought is going. Is this true or is this not true? And so Hagen, he also places his value, at least uses people in that way. Hagen says, not only by right of power, but also by right of inheritance, it's his, because it was Albrecht's ring in the first place. Gunther has first said, would you touch Gutrun's inheritance, you shameless son of Albrecht? Yeah, he's shameless and he's conscienceless. He's another son of the widow. This is another side all over again. Wagner very skillfully brings this out, that he's the son of Albrecht, and he's not this, this is the stepson, that this is the demon's son. And so in every moment that is of consequence, in every big event, especially, there are two events. There is the act of spiritual conception when we get the idea to come back to birth, which is at one end of the cycle. And then there is the death, which is at the other end of the cycle. And those two represent like the staff of Mercury. They represent the connection of the center of the whole creative cycle. Everything from third heaven spins forward. At death, the swan song begins, everything spins backwards at that moment. And therefore, everything that is inherent in the whole creative drama is at the moment of dissolution, when things begin to break down and return to the unity, is there. So in the same way that Wagner is clearly alluding back to the Adam and Eve drama, or the Eve and Samael drama, And it is the Lucifer that started with murder in the first place that started this whole downturn, because in some ways you're murdering the universal every time you come into the particular. Because the universal dies in order for particular things to come into being. But when the particular dies and things start to go back to the universal, the whole drama is lived all over of Adam and Eve all over again. And so what happens is Hagen kills Gunther. You just pull out a sword and kills him. And you don't talk that way to me. That ring is mine. By inheritance, it's mine. You've already said that I'm the son of Albrecht, and Albrecht formed this ring in the first place. And so in the same way that there is that the first sin, the sin of selfish use of the creative energy by Adam and Eve led to the second sin, the sin of murder in Abel and Cain, here the same thing is repeated in the death cycle. And so on the way up, back to the universal, the same moment is repeated as it happened on the fall. So it's the same thing that happened as soon as the selfishness was physically manifest in Fafnir, he killed the salt. And so it's the same thing is all over again. But then something really remarkable happens. Hagen goes over to the body of Siegfried to take the ring off of it, and the arm of Siegfried comes snapping up. And Hagen falls back, and the whole crowd screams. And, ultimately, evil has to be repulsed by good. That it can't stand the truth. Because even, what I'm trying to say, even though it can make all of the counterfeits that are imitations of it, it can't stand the truth. The ideal of the truth seeker is to come closer day by day, moment by moment, to be able to look the spirit of truth in the eye, to be able to hold the consciousness on that one center of being and really be able to look at it without being blinded or ashamed or forced away from it. Just the opposite with the evildoer, and so he's repulsed by that. And at this moment, Brunhilde enters. Whew. And Brunhilde has quite a few things to say, and quite a few of them we're going to read. And she says, "Silence the clamorous outpouring of your grief. She whom ye all betrayed, his wife, now comes for vengeance. I heard children crying to their mother because they had spilled milk, but I did not hear a lament befitting the loss of the noblest of heroes." So she silences them all with her very beautiful, when you hear the truth, it's more dumbing than anything else you can imagine. She's saying, here you're all wrapped up in your selfishness over the ring, and not over the loss of the most wonderful of all of the heroes, the truth seeker that really sought and lived the truth. Gutrune is still filled with bitterness and curses her for setting the men against Siegfried. And Brunhilde silences her, but by telling her that we were consorts. She doesn't use bride in this sense. He uses the word consort for Brunhilde. Going all the way back to like when we talked in the first myths of the gods and goddesses, the Titans that were married to each other, that were brother and sister and husband and wife both. They were always consorts to each other. And we're now back again on the notion of the original adultery. The adultery, once we have gained union between the personality and the individuality, that takes precedence above everything else, and adultery to that is the true adultery. Gutruna, then seeing the sense of it, curses Hagen. She now knows the truth, and she admits to the truth, and then begins Brunhilde's, it's a long, beautiful farewell. I think it takes almost a half an hour to sing it all, because there's a lot of very poignant pauses in it, and it calls back all of the things from all of the operas you can hear in the background. And she bids all of the vassals to build a huge funeral pyre. He goes the same way that Heracles does. And she bids the vassals to bring his horse. And she then sings a beautiful, beautiful thing in his honor, showing how even he was faithful in his ignorance. She says, like clear sunshine, his light shines upon me. Purest of beings was he who was traitor to me. False to his wife, true to his friend, from his own true love, his only beloved, he barred himself with his sword. More loyally than he, none ever swore vows. More faithfully than he, none ever kept compact. More pure than he, none ever loved. And yet all vows, all compacts, the truest love, none like him has betrayed. Do you know how that was? O ye, the eternal guardian of vows, turn your eyes on my full-flowing grief. Behold your everlasting guilt. She's talking to Wotan now. Hear my charge, most venerable God. Through his bravest deed, by thee desired, thou didst doom him who had performed it. To the curse which has befallen you, he, truest of all, had to betray me, that a woman might find wisdom. Have I learned all that avails thee? All things, all now I know. All is clear to my eyes. The wings of the ravens I hear rustling. I send them home to thee with news both feared and longed for. Rest thou, O God. So she brings up a number of themes here. She shows that, in the first place, Siegfried was the true altruistic hero, because what he did out of friendship. He kept his honor in that way. The truth he did for others' sake, not just for himself. And it's possible, even in our ignorance, to be true. It's possible that if we are honest with ourselves, even if we don't know a whole lot, we can still be heroes. And if we act guilelessly, and if we live queenly in even our ignorance, we still qualify as heroes. At this point, she has the vassals lift the corpse onto the pyre, and she now takes the ring. She says, my heritage now I take for my own, a cursed ring, dread ring, I grasp the gold and give it away. Ye wise sisters of the watery deep, ye swimming daughters of the Rhine, I thank you for your good counsel. What ye desire, I now give to you out of my ashes. Take it for your own. May the fire that burns me cleanse the ring from the curse. Dissolve it in the stream, and ever keep safe the pure shining gold whose theft wrought such evil. The first act of the true self when taking the self in full knowledge. It's clear now that by the act of the what was done as a selfish deed to win the lust of a womanly world, the spirit of truth has been rapaciously taken down to the material world. But the spirit of truth, being what it is, can see through all of the ways of the material world and in suffering in it and actually passing through the material world becomes wise, and in that wisdom redeems the universal truth in the particular. But there's a price. It's going to dissolve the particular. It's going to dissolve the material away. And so the first act then of the spirit, when it claims the ring of selfhood for itself, the first act of the spirit is to give it up to the flame. That is to give it back up to the universal spirit and back to the innocent sisters. And she gives her intent. Now she begins to prophesy. Fly home, ye ravens. Tell your Lord what you heard here on the Rhine. Fly past Brunhilde's rock, where Loge is still flaming, and bid him go to Valhalla, for the end of the gods is now dawning. See, I throw the firebrand into Valhalla's glorious citadel. And she grabs a faggot and she tosses it into the funeral pyre. She's looking here for the purgative value of fire. Everything has to go back to the primal elements. And if, as we saw in the creative myths last year, everything, when it came out of Prajapati, out of that fire, now everything returns to that fire. And she is now making this a matter of the death of the earth and the death of heaven. She then gets on the horse and urges the horse onto the funeral pyre. And she has it leap in. And as the funeral pyre takes off, it starts to burn, and the flames burn right up the side of the rock, and you see Valhalla, the extra barricade of ash wood, that the dead ash wood of Wotan catches on fire. And so Valhalla and the realm of the Gibichungs both go up in flame at the same time. And it's almost identical to the creation story in the Bible. The last destruction, the destruction of Atlantis, was by a flood, and the promise of the next one is by a fire. And as the fire goes up, the ravens fly up, and they fly up to Valhalla, and there's an ultimate collapse, and everything goes back to the primal elements, because at this point, the Rhine River overflows, and the Rhine maidens with it. And there's a collapse of all boundaries now. The distinct has left, and it has gone over to the chaotic realm of indistinction, where everything is coming into a state of greater unity. And at this last moment, as the body of Brunhilde is dying and letting go of the ring, Hagen tries to get the ring. But the Rhine maidens now in the water, they grab both Hagen. Oh. They grab both Hagen and the ring and pull them under. And they sing joyously that they now have their treasure back. And so we have come full circle. What began in innocence in the Rhine River ends in innocence in Rhine River. And it's been a circle. it's been a ring, but it's been a ring that's been a tremendous experience. If there's anything about the spiritual life that is at all valuable, it is the experience of it. It is the living in it and having the privilege of trying, and just having that experience. The whole thing is mimicked in the full story of the destruction. All of the elements struggle with each other. All of the children of Loge, Fenris, the wolf who represented Air, fights it out with Wotan, and they both die. And the Midgard serpent, which represents water, which represents the Rhine River, fights it out with Thor, and they mutually destroy each other. Thor keeps throwing lightning bolts until he has nothing left, and all the water is dissolved by the lightning, and some people believe that that's what's happening in our cosmos, that in the world, that everything is becoming dry, that every time that there is lightning, that there is electrolysis of the vapor in the air, and the oxygen gets fixed onto nitrogen, and acid rains down and eats through the earth, and the hydrogen floats back to chaos, and the primal element is associated with the primal chaos again. And Hel, who represents the earth, smothers the fire, and everything ends in one big gigantic collapse of night, which is called the Twilight of the Gods, or the Götterdämmerungen, the damnation or the ending of the gods. If the creative word has to be spoken, that word itself must come full cycle. And if creation is a word that was from the beginning, that word betrays itself and it destroys its own creation, and everything is completely dissolved, and the ring rings out in its full cycle, and everything comes to a close. That's about it. I'm going to try and do about three more talks. There's one more kind of hero myth I want to cover, but it's going to be a little bit rough and choppy because I won't have all of the time to prepare that I did take to prepare these, because I have other things that I'm going to have to do. If you want to read ahead for what we're going to look into, we're going to look into the Sangreal section of the La Morte d'Arthur, that is the death of King Arthur. We're not going to cover the death of King Arthur. We're just going to talk about the Grail Knights and the consummation of the Holy Grail, those who consummated that mystery, and those who failed, and those who sort of consummated it. And that'll be as much as we're going to have to say about heroes when we get through that.